Sean Spicer make all kinds of excuses and about how hard it would be to comply with our requests. Come on, man. Look, General Flynn served in his position for 24 days. So that excuse from the White House will not fly. I honestly do not understand why the White House is covering up for Michael Flynn. I don't get it. After the president fired him for lying.
Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings speaking at a press conference today, saying the White House is stalling on turning over documents related to the investigation of General Michael Flynn. Cummings is the ranking Democrat on the House Oversight Committee. He released Army documents today that show Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor, had been warned not to accept foreign government payments back in 2014. But that did not stop Flynn from accepting a $45,000 speaking fee 1 year later from the Kremlin-backed news network RT. The documents released today also show the Defense Department's top watchdog opened an investigation into those payments and others earlier this month. Flynn also offered to testify before Congress, before committees that are looking into Trump's campaign ties to Russia in exchange for immunity. Well, here to talk about Flynn and how he was ensnared in the scandal is Nicholas Schmidl. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So why are these payments so controversial if he accepted them after he retired?
They're controversial because as a former government official who is holding on to security clearances, they are potentially compromising. You just don't accept money from foreign governments if you're still holding top secret security clearances.
Right, and you at least need to alert people, right, that you are doing this or you're contemplating it.
Correct. I mean, so before Mike Flynn went to Moscow in December of 2015 for this Russia Today speaking gig, he did go to the Defense Intelligence Agency, where he had previously been the director, and he did brief. He did have briefings with them both before and after the trip. What is new today is the revelation that he had been warned against accepting money. What happened in the rest of that conversation. The fact is that Mike Flynn did accept money knowingly that it was coming from Russia Today, which is a government-backed media organization. But the money, he was actually paid by his Speaker's Bureau. So, you know, the Speaker's Bureau laundered is a cynical word, but the Speaker's Bureau was the one who actually paid Mike Flynn.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote a really big profile of Flynn recently for The New Yorker, and you really trace his career from when he was a very respected three-star general and to where he is now, where some of even his closest allies or people who worked with him back in the day are kind of scratching their heads and wondering what's become of him. Why would he consider speaking in Moscow?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's a good question for Mike Flynn to potentially. I think that some of these congressional committees, I'm sure, would love to have Mike Flynn testify and answer that very question. When Flynn was forcibly removed, when Flynn was dismissed from being the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency in the summer of 2014, there's a time when he's trying to figure out what to do next. He starts doing some media and finds that his sort of the iconoclasm that made him such a celebrated figure in the military began to sort of overwhelm his personality, in the sense that anything that came out of the Obama White House was considered what he was sort of branding as treasonous and against the interest, national security interest of the United States. So he went on Russia Today. I went on RT in the fall of 2015. Criticizing American airstrikes in Syria, or actually praising Russian airstrikes in Syria. And he was subsequently invited to come to this 10-year anniversary gala for RT. And who showed up for the dinner that evening and who sat next to Flynn at the head table but Vladimir Putin?
Hmm. He also seems to be obsessed with Iran and with trying to get people to believe that Iran is our biggest threat. So how would that square with this praise of Vladimir Putin and Putin's airstrikes in Syria?
Yeah, it's actually it's a little bit difficult to disentangle, because Russia and Iran are in many ways allies on numerous fronts. I think that there was a thought that maybe this pro-Russia policy that was being espoused by Flynn and by Trump and by others in the Trump administration leading into taking office was going to result in sort of amplified pressure on Iran somehow. I don't know sort of how he squared his sort of anti-Iran sentiments with his pro-Russia sentiments. I do know that the anti-Iran sentiments are not unique to Mike Flynn. There are servicemen and women who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan have seen at a granular level how Iran has, I mean, there have been allegations of Iranian interference in military interference in Iraq and Afghanistan for a decade, more than a decade. And so those, you know, what Flynn thought he saw was that the administration, the Obama administration, was overlooking some of those activities because they were pursuing diplomatic, there were diplomatic pursuits over trying to resolve the nuclear issue. So, you know, it's a thorny set of issues, but Flynn tried to oversimplify it, and it's never quite as simple as it seems.
So he is ousted from the Obama administration. He ends his military career. And is that when he begins to nurture or nurse a grudge or some kind of animus towards President Obama? Because on the campaign trail, when he is on the Trump campaign team, he makes some pretty astonishing statements.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I spoke to a lot of people who served with Mike Flynn in the military and over the last 2 years that he was there when he was the director of the DIA. No one that I spoke to recalled hearing Mike Flynn sort of disparage Barack Obama necessarily – I don't directly sort of disparage administration policies. But – privately, there was a sense, you know, people had the sense that he did disagree with the way that the ISIS campaign was being conducted and the way the policy towards Iran was sort of progressing. So when he is pushed out, his own position changes. I mean, he initially says that he's pushed out because he's at the end of his career and it was time for him to move on, and he then changes and starts making it very much that, you know, Obama wanted to remove him because Flynn was sort of, you know, speaking truth to power. That is not the way that it unfolded. It unfolded. He largely was removed from his job at the DIA because of management issues. And, you know, part of this iconoclasm that I referred to earlier, he tried to bring to a big bureaucratic intelligence agency, and it did not go over well. And he's not a great manager, which is why when he was chosen to be the national security advisor, I think it raised a lot of concerns that his last job dealing with large staffs ended abruptly and did not go over well, and his tenure was not seen as being a productive one.
Yeah. So then he sort of questions whether or not Obama is an American and intimates that he's a Muslim and all that kind of stuff on the campaign
Correct.
Trail. And so even, you know, some of his people like Stan McChrystal are saying, come on, tone it down. What are you doing out there? Who is he? I mean, was he always that kind of nurturing, the sort of hard-edged, angry firebrand? Or did he become that when he ended his military career?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of everything. So if we remind people, you know, Stanley McChrystal, who was Flynn's mentor, is a little bit too sort of stratified of a dynamic to describe. But, you know, McChrystal was a 4-star general when Flynn, or was a 3-star general when Flynn was a 2-star general. They served together in Iraq and Afghanistan later. And, you know, Flynn, like many of those who served around McChrystal, revered McChrystal. And McChrystal, if you recall, you know, he was there was a Rolling Stone article that came out in which McChrystal and his staff were speaking ill of the Obama administration, and that led to McChrystal's firing. That did not go over well at all with Flynn to see someone of McChrystal's reputation and caliber publicly humiliated, and I think that that stung, and I think that that sort of resentment was festering from that time up until the time that you know he left the military and could sort of speak his mind, and the gloves came off, as it were.
Yeah. So then he and Trump are like hand in glove, and they seem to get along really well, and he's installed as national security advisor, and then the whole thing comes out about him having these talks with the Russian ambassador about sanctions, possibly easing sanctions, and he loses his job. He is asked for immunity in exchange for testifying before Congress, and he says he has a story to tell. What do you think that story is?
That's a great question. I think that this story, it's the question of why he offered to testify and why that offer was not accepted raises all kinds of questions, which is that perhaps the investigative bodies, namely the FBI, already has everything that he might be able to offer. Whether that's through other sources, whether through other witnesses or through various sort of intelligence streams that they may be able to corroborate, or they may already know the story that Flynn is going to tell. It's just it's you know, you, when you're asking for immunity, and those who are able to grant it don't know whether you're going to get up there and bluster and say you don't know anything, or you're going to sort of dance around the facts, or, you know, I spoke to Flynn 2 days before the inauguration and asked him about his conversation with the Russian ambassador, and he played it off as being a very innocuous conversation. So I think that Flynn is also capable of sort of dealing with a alternative fact pattern, as many in this administration are, it seems. And so as to, you know, what it is that he has to offer, I don't know. But that may be why there's some reluctance to sort of take him up on that offer.
Yeah. And so the question being, did he just go rogue and have these conversations on his own, or was he directed to have these conversations?
Yeah, I think that it's highly unlikely that he went rogue. I think that he, you know, when Mike Flynn was the director of the DIA, he made a very unconventional trip to Moscow to interact with senior military intelligence officials in the Russian military intelligence organization called the GRU. So he had established these relationships, and it's hard, you know, we don't yet know exactly why Trump brought him on. We don't know why he went to Moscow, but he did have existing contacts. And as one senior military intelligence official speculated, the likelihood that Mike Flynn was conducting these back channel conversations and negotiations with the Russian ambassador is highly unlikely. What's much more unlikely is that someone in the Trump administration that wanted to make sure a message was conveyed to Russia knew that Mike Flynn had contacts. He had corresponded with the Russian ambassador before, as he was preparing his trip to Moscow. And that, you know, as this military intelligence official said, you know, someone in the Trump administration may well have said to Flynn, you know, hey, you've got contacts, you make the call. So I do not think that Mike Flynn was acting alone here.
Nicholas Schmidl, he's a staff writer at The New Yorker, where you can read his profile on Michael Flynn. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, there are no fewer than 6 documentaries on the LA riots to mark the 25th anniversary. Our own Matt Holzman watched all of them. He'll be here to tell you all about it next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's continue our coverage now of the LA riots. The 25th anniversary is this weekend, and yesterday, John Ridley took us inside his documentary, Let It Fall. But there are actually several new documentaries offering their take on what's been called the uprising, the civil disturbance, the riots, those 5 days of mayhem that left some 50 people dead and 2,000 people injured and caused over $1 billion in damage. Our own Matt Holzman is here to go over those films with me. He now hosts a new KCRW podcast called The Document, which is all about documentary film. Hi.
Hi.
So you watched all of those documentaries, six documentaries. You must know everything there is to know about what happened 25 years ago.
I do. I'm now teaching a class at UCLA about it. It's interesting that you said the 5 days, because for a documentary filmmaker, the big question, of course, is where does the story really begin? And each one of these films answers that question in a slightly different way. It's also interesting that they're talking about the same topic and the same dates and the same people, and yet there are some subtle and not so subtle differences that you really have to watch for. And as you're watching these movies, you're asking yourself, what is the purpose of this movie? Is this a history lesson? Is this to teach somebody who wasn't around at the time what happened? Is this a way of looking back at history to understand something about where we are today? Is this trying to get people into some kind of action about injustice or the root causes? And each one answers that question a little differently, but you really hit it, I think, up top, which is the kind of Rorschach question about what happened in those 5 days is, was it a riot? Was it a civil disturbance? Was it a political action? And I think that when you watch these movies, each one of them has an answer to that, and it kind of tells you really what the movie is about.
Mm, interesting. And the perspective of the filmmaker, of course. So right. Let's go through them. The Smithsonian Channel has a film called The Lost Tapes.
Too many officers feel that if your face is black in this city, then you are viewed as a criminal.
You have brought dishonor to the city of Los Angeles, and you should resign.
There's tremendous tension in those streets. You hope it will not explode.
Okay, so that is the Smithsonian's Lost Tapes. What would you say was the perspective of this film?
I think if we're wondering what is the answer to the question, what happened in those days? Was it a riot? Was it a civil disturbance? I think the answer in this case is it was a riot, because mm-hmm. this is a movie that is essentially the most sensational of all of them, showing the most violent footage kind of over and over and over again, not providing a lot of context or new information. If there's something that makes it stand out, it is kind of this Lost Tapes aspect, where they use some tapes from the local community radio station KJLH, which we've also heard but not as often. And hearing the people on the air there talk about what is going on gives you such a keen perspective from what people on the street were really feeling. Because, yes, there was outrage, but there was also the sense that their own neighborhood was burning down. And those tapes are probably the most affecting part of that entire documentary.
Okay, there's another one called LA 92. This is put out by the National Geographic Channel, and here's a clip.
This is where it began. This is where the fuse was lighted. It began with the arrest by white officers of the California Highway Patrol of two young Negroes, one on a charge of drunk driving, the other his brother, his passenger. Their mother, who lives nearby, came to the scene. There was an argument. There was a scuffle. By then, a crowd of several hundred Negroes had gathered, and the story of police brutality quickly spread through the community.
Okay, so that's a soundbite from a newscast, I suppose, a reporter at least,
right,
from 1965, not 1992.
Right, and so this is a film that begins and ends with the Watts riots as a kind of a starting and ending point, and which makes a lot of sense because the two events are not disconnected. This is a film made by two talented filmmakers, and it has an attitude that is a little more emotional and a little less sensational. There is a real sense of the human aftermath. You see people in shelters. That's footage that I don't recall ever having seen before of people who are displaced by the riots. And also, you hear George Bush's speech at the time. George H.W. Bush's speech to the nation. During his speech, there's a montage of footage of the aftermath of the riots. And it is an incredibly compelling piece of documentary filmmaking, because you can see how much he's missing the point. He means it. He's earnest. He really is. But he is just missing the point of what has happened there and why. And you get a very strong sense of that from the end of this movie. It's a really affecting couple of minutes of film.
All right. Moving on to John Singleton, best known for that movie Boys in the Hood, which came out just before the riots. His new documentary is called L.A. Burning, The Riots 25 Years Later. Here's a clip from the trailer.
This is a brutalization of truth. That's the tragedy of America.
We thought that videotape was going to make a difference 25 years ago.
A state of emergency has been declared in Los Angeles County.
It is the intersection of Florence and Normandy.
The people will only be suppressed for so long until they lash out.
Okay, John Singleton's documentary, and it begins with the most recent police shootings. It begins in the present, right?
Right. So this is the only one of the documentaries that really ties the police brutality of then with the police brutality of now. It both begins and ends with a kind of a litany of the young black men who have died at the hands of the police, which I think is, I mean, if you don't mention that, you kind of think, where is that? Because it seems like they're tied together so tightly. The other thing that's kind of interesting about this film is, like you say, John Singleton had just come out with Boys in the Hood like the year before. And so he was a real celebrity in that part of town. And there's interviews with him during the riots. And he is the kind of quintessentially angry black man. He's dressed like it. He's playing that persona to the hilt. And now there are interviews with him today, and he's more the elder statesman. And he's a little more he couches what he says in a little more kind verbiage, but he's saying exactly the same thing, which is like, what did you expect? Mm. And even though we do see a lot of interviews with people then and now, because we know him kind of so well, seeing him then and now really is a very powerful connection to what happened then. And it's a real interesting part of the film. But I do think it seemed obvious to me, and the first film we talked about started with the beating of Rodney King. That was one really obvious way to go. I assume no one would do that. But John Singleton has used this connection to all these deaths, which seemed like the most powerful way to film, and he's the only one that did that.
All right, let's move on to another one on Showtime by Sasha Jenkins. It's called Burn, Mother Effer, Burn. So I'm guessing that title says something about the point of view.
Yeah, well, very much so. You know, Sasha Jenkins is a guy who's deeply involved in documenting the black experience. He did a documentary called Fresh Dress that talked about hip-hop fashion, and he's a musician, and he's really a polyglot guy. And this is the most kind of powerful and angry of the movies. It starts with one of the most shocking pieces of tape I've ever seen, which is a black news reporter in 1950-something talking to a plantation owner about the quote-unquote humanization of blacks. And the black interviewer says, well, what did you think of us before you saw us as humans? And the plantation owner says, well, in a way, we thought of you almost as a very superior pet, something we had to take care of. And the movie has an edgy. This is the only movie that has Malcolm X in it. It's the only one that really talks about Chief Parker and redlining and all of the very core reasons why we got to the Watts riots and then why we got to the 92 riots and why it's possible that we could have another riot someday, you know, soon, given what's going on in the world. I will say probably the most amazing part of this movie, though, is that they interview Chief Beck, the chief of police right now. And Chief Beck is a politician, and he's a very smart guy, and he's very well-spoken. But it's so shocking to hear him say some of the things that he says. First of all, he basically admits that he believes that the verdict in 92 was wrong. Okay, that's safe enough. But then he goes on to talk about that he really still thinks that black men need to be able to know how to deal with cops when a cop pulls them over. He doesn't understand. I mean, after all these years, he still doesn't quite get that. And that tape is probably the most powerful of any of the tape of the movies that I watched.
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, we talked with John Ridley yesterday about his movie Let It Fall. What did you think of it?
Well, I know we have a bit of a disagreement about this film. I mean, this is a very, very well-made film, and it's very affecting. He has interviews, very extensive, well-conducted interviews with all of kind of the main people who are still alive from the 92 riots. I think my problem with the film is that it feels like the same story being told again. I know most of these stories incredibly well. It feels a little unemotional to me. It felt to me also like I was desperate for the voice of an everyday person, not a headliner. Mm-hmm. But having said that, the interviews are incredibly compelling, and it's very, very well put together. I mean, it's really a slick movie.
Yeah, I will say that it has been 25 years. You were here then, but many people in Los Angeles were not.
Right. And, well, it goes back to my question, what is the movie intending to do?
Right.
And this is probably the best history lesson in a way, although it starts with the riots and doesn't refer to a lot of the things that happened before. And I think to talk about the 92 riots without talking about the 65 riots is an interesting decision. But as you pointed out when we discussed this before, where do you start?
He starts 10 years before. And
right.
He does lead up to it, but he chooses 10 years before and then
right.
And he doesn't go to 65 and he doesn't go to the know, 1930s or 40s.
Right. Or he doesn't go back to the beginning of slavery, which is you could do that. I think maybe just a tip of the hat to 65 since that was – this felt like so much of an echo of that. But again, having said that, seeing these people talk about their personal stories and how painful and how powerful they were is – it's very affecting. But I have to say, there is one other kind of very much smaller production. There's a documentary filmmaker named Grace Lee who's made some wonderful movies. And she's doing a kind of a web multimedia project called K-Town 92. And as part of that project, she's directed a short film that talks with three young LA Times reporters at the time, one who was Hispanic, Hector Tobar, that we all know, a woman named Tamerlan Drummond, who's not around anymore. She's African-American. And John Lee, who was Korean. And they talk about how the LA Times dealt with the riot and how the LA Times is a proxy for kind of like the establishment viewed South Central and what was happening there. There's a couple of things that are interesting to me. One is that Grace is a Korean filmmaker, and that's an unusual point of view, different from everybody else who's created these movies. And I think creates with John Lee a better understanding of the Korean experience. In all the other movies, we basically see the Koreans shooting and all that kind of stuff. So there's a little more of that in this film. But also, you can't help watch this movie and it ends and you just think, well, nothing has changed. I mean, literally nothing. With the others, you can say, oh, well, gee, you know, this has happened and that has happened. But there is something about seeing how the media covers what's happening and the media's understanding, which is it's the mediator for the public to understand what's going on, how bad a job it did then, and in some ways how bad a job we still do today. It is true also, I have to say, I've just watched a lot of movies that have a lot of anger and history in them. I do think things are different. I do think things are better. I am maybe surprised that they aren't even better given what we know. I mean, just from watching these movies, what we know about especially the African-American experience in the United States.
Matt Holzman, he's the host of KCRW's new podcast. It's called The Document. You can listen to it at kcrw.com/The Document. You can download it and subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Matt.
You're welcome.
Coming up, an unusual examination of the JonBenet Ramsey case. And a lot of bizarre murder theories.
What was fascinating to me was just how wide-ranging and diverse those theories are. I mean, everything from, you know, a pedophile ring to devil cult worship.
The new documentary, Casting JonBenet, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 21 years ago, a young pageant queen was found dead, murdered in the basement of her family's home.
The police were searching the house.
That's when they opened the door to the wine cellar and saw her covered in her favorite white blanket.
It was the biggest thing to happen to Boulder in a very long time.
Her name was JonBenet Ramsey, and she was 6 years old. Theories about who did it ran wild. Was it her mom, her dad, her older brother, an intruder? To this day, no one knows. The case was never solved. A new documentary about JonBenet does not attempt to find out what really happened. Instead, the film, Casting JonBenet, is an experiment in the human imagination, from the grotesque to the traumatic. And with us now is the director, Kitty Green. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what drew you to this case, to the JonBenet Ramsey story?
I think I was 10 or 11 when it happened, and I was a kid in Australia, and we don't have beauty pageants in Australia, so it's a uniquely American phenomenon. So I was curious right away. And I also grew up on those American sitcoms with these ideal, kind of picture-perfect families, and this kind of case like punctured that image for me. So yeah, I was curious and the case just stuck with me.
Yeah, I think it's stuck with a lot of people. I think the beauty queen, the child beauty pageant scene was largely unknown until this happened, and that it was fascinating for lots of people. And again, as you say, this seemed like the perfect American family, wealthy family in Colorado, and yet this horrific murder took place.
Yeah, I think, and also, it's, I mean, it's one of those cases that people don't seem to let go. It's 20 years later, and she's still on the cover of magazines. There's been multiple television specials, at least 20 books about the case. So, yeah, we were kind of interested, well, especially, I was interested in the cultural obsession, really, the legacy and mythology of ChonBenet Ramsey.
So you weren't interested in finding out what happened?
Not really. I mean, yes, of course, innately. but it was really more about, I mean, I read every book and I watched every special, and there is no way we'll know, at least in the foreseeable future, who did it. So what was interesting to me was how a community that lived in the shadow of this crime for the past 20 years, how do they come to terms with not knowing and not ever knowing? Like, how do they deal with ambiguity and uncertainty and doubt? So that became the focus of this project.
Did you originally set out to do it in the way you did? And in the way you did it was by making a movie about the casting of making a movie.
My name's Hannah, and I'm auditioning for the role of ChonBenet Ramsey.
Hello, I'm Amy Dowd, and I'm auditioning for the role of Patsy Ramsey.
My name is Ryan, and I'm auditioning for the role of Burke.
Yeah, I'd made a short film that used a similar sort of structural conceit, basically, where we held open casting calls in Ukraine to play the figure skater Oksana Bayul. And we auditioned a bunch of little girls in Ukraine who, when they were auditioning to play this figure skater, they opened up about life during the conflict in Ukraine. So it became kind of like a vehicle to explore kind of bigger, deeper issues. That short film won the prize at Sundance, and immediately everyone says, well, how can we see a feature film with a similar kind of structure? And I sort of blurted out ChonBenet Ramsey, and 3 months later moved to Boulder, Colorado, and was, yeah, beginning this experiment, I guess.
So did you send out a casting call? How did you go about making this movie?
Yeah, I mean, we did open casting calls. We basically said, come down if you want to be in a film. But when people sat down, I mean, you'll notice in the film, they're all dressed up in costumes, they're on sets. So before they actually were interviewed, I explained to them that this was a unique project, that the casting material was going to be used within the film, that multiple people will be playing Patsy Ramsey or John Ramsey, that we're not your typical docudrama, and asked if people were kind of willing to jump down the rabbit hole with us. And 99% of people were, yeah, excited to be part of the experiment, which was fabulous.
But did they think a film would be made? A film that they would be in?
Yeah, I mean, their film was made. I mean, they play out in the final sequence in this film a series of reenactments of what happened that night in the Ramsey house. And that was all I promised them. Do you know what I mean? We had to be honest with them because we needed them to be honest with us.
But what comes out in the movie is it's really about them, not about the players in the ChonBenet Ramsey story. So it's not really about Patsy Ramsey or John Ramsey or ChonBenet or the brother or whoever else. It's really about the actors wanting to play these characters. Did they fully understand that?
Yeah, I mean, they were aware of that we were looking at the community. We were looking at people's reflections, thoughts, memories, individual kind of interpretations of this crime. That's what we were interested in. So yeah, what was surprising to me was how organic the process was. Like, I sat them down and we just asked them about the ChonBenet Ramsey case. And immediately, one woman would say, well, I think Patsy Ramsey did it because my mother had bipolar disorder. So, therefore, I think maybe Patsy had bipolar disorder because of A, B, and C. And she would go on her own sort of tangent. And so the film is built on these stories from people, like the way people have come to terms with this kind of incredible tragedy that happened in their town, and the way they make sense of it based on their own personal experience.
I found someone close to me dead, and it's an awful experience. I understand this idea of people thinking things about you, of, you know, the immediate rush of somebody wanting to find somebody to blame and to have fingers pointed at you falsely.
You know, it's hard for me. It's hard for me sitting here talking about it as myself. To not just, I mean, I'm holding back, weeping over the loss, you know? Because I myself have lost 3 children. So I know what that feels like.
It is really interesting that they all saw this crime through the filter of their own lives and their own traumas. Was that surprising to you?
We were hoping we'd get that sort of reaction from people, but what amazed us was just how vulnerable these people were with us, how honest, how open. I mean, Australians are very private people. I don't think we could have made this film in Australia, but Americans love to talk. It was kind of exciting for me to be in the room as they told me these stories.
And plus it was in the town, Boulder, where the crime took place. So they had a special connection to it.
Yes, yeah, some people knew, were neighbors. Everyone had a connection in some way. They either knew the dog walker who walked the dog of the Ramsey's friend. Like, it was all sort of those sort of, some more tenuous than others connections that we were kind of interested in. But it was also just about the media circus. It's sort of been there for the last 20 years. They can't escape it. It's sort of we're looking at the imprint of this crime, essentially, on a community.
But what's also fascinating is they all think that they're, theory is the true theory, that they're experts, that they think they know what happened.
There's definitely some strong opinions in there. I mean, we interviewed 200 people. There's 72 people in the film. And yeah, I mean, what was fascinating to me was just how wide-ranging and diverse those theories are. I mean, everything from, you know, a pedophile ring to devil cult worship. Like, there's some strange theories in there.
Maybe she was letting someone have time with her daughter in some kind of weird sex thing, and that got carried away and it went too far.
I definitely believe that JonBenet Ramsey was fed pineapple.
I know there was a Santa Claus that was at the party that maybe could have done it.
Yeah, we got a lot of crazy stories out of people.
Was there something, though, about the process of getting them in costume and putting them on a set, sort of a rendition of the Ramsey's house, hair and makeup, of that whole process that got them to open up to say things that maybe they wouldn't have said if they were just in their regular clothes?
Perhaps. Maybe it was the costumes. I think we created a very safe space. It was just me and a camera that they were sitting in front of. And yeah, I think they found it, I don't know, kind of therapeutic to discuss their own interpretations and their own feelings surrounding this kind of this tragedy.
And there are parts of the auditions that are really funny. I mean, it's almost as if we, or I should say I as a viewer, because I don't want to assume other people's reactions. I mean, you laugh a little bit at the actors in certain instances. And there's one guy who says he's a sex educator and he demonstrates what he means by that. And it's humorous. Was that your intention, to mix the pathos and the humor?
It's such a heavy subject matter. The death of a 6-year-old girl is horrific. So, you know, we needed some moments of lightness. We just needed the audience to be able to exhale every now and again, to take a breath.
Right. And then also, as a viewer, I found myself being a lot like the actors, like theorizing on what really happened and bringing myself into it, in a sense. Did you intend that too, for the viewers to also be a part of it?
Definitely. I mean, it's a film about individual interpretation. So, of course, I hope the audience will kind of interpret it individually in some way. I get sucked into those true crime shows the way everyone else does. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of, I'm interested in that obsession. Like, why are we so fascinated by these cases and why can't we let them go?
So the focus is mainly on Patsy. Why is that, do you think? And why are people so fascinated with her?
I make documentaries about women and their representation in the media, and I've done that for several years now. So I was immediately drawn to this case because of the way the press kind of crucified Patsy, and everyone was so critical of her parenting skills and how dare she put her child in pageants. And I read that in the media, and actually I was quite surprised that the community shared similar opinions.
I mean, the mother had to do it. She was about to turn 40. She's jealous. Her little girl was frustrating. She wet the bed.
She seems more inclined to be the one that might have struck someone in anger than John does.
So this movie uses the JonBenet case to explore different aspects of human nature. But this was a real case. I mean, we have to keep that in mind. A young girl in real life was killed. A family was destroyed. Were you conflicted at all about treating the death as a spectacle in a way? Did you feel like maybe you were doing in small part what the news media did in terms of turning it into entertainment?
Yeah, there have been so many JonBenet Ramsey films, and we've tried to set ourselves apart from them. First of all, there's no footage of the actual family in our film. We don't have any archival footage, which is unusual for a documentary. We've taken steps to separate ourselves, but what we've essentially made is not a film about the JonBenet Ramsey case. We've made a film about a community and how a community deal with loss and uncertainty, and so that was always more important to us.
So was that specifically because you didn't want to contribute to that, that you didn't want to exploit JonBenet and the family again?
We don't want to further exploit the story, but we were looking at kind of the broader themes of what you do with a story like this. When the press and the media can't let it go, how do we move forward? How do we find closure? That's what we were interested in.
And do you think there is closure with this, since we'll never know what happened?
Well, I hope there is some sense of we will not ever know. So why continue? Like, hopefully we can close the book on this. Maybe I'm being a little too optimistic. But the idea that we can move forward and that we don't have to keep recycling this same story over and over again would hopefully be a lovely outcome. I think the actors themselves found it quite a cathartic process. I mean, they've been living it with this crime and unable to escape it for 20 years. So they were grateful to just sort of get out, air their grievances and their pain and all of their kind of feelings they had that were caught up with this case. We gave them a forum for that through it.
Well, Norma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kitty Green. She's the director of the documentary film Casting JonBenet, which you can stream on Netflix beginning tomorrow. Coming up, Shani Jardin is here to weigh in on tech news, including a new service by Amazon's Alexa that acts as a judgy mirror, telling you if those jeans make you look fat. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Net neutrality, rest in peace. And Amazon wants Alexa to judge whether or not you look good in those jeans. It's Thursday, and that means Shani Jardin is here. She's a co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web guru. Hi.
Hi. I think maybe my title should change to your dystopian tour guide. Because every week there's something grim and weird.
Okay, I know. Yeah. You're not excited about Alexa choosing your outfits, right?
I'm concerned that Alexa is going to start telling me my butt looks big.
Okay, we're going to get to that in a second. Yeah. First, let's get to the real news. And that is FCC Chair Ajit Pai outlined his plans to undo these net neutrality rules. And these rules really require internet companies to treat everyone the same. And
yes.
So everyone gets to be on the same freeway, traveling at the same speed, right?
Right. And essentially what Trump's new FCC chairman is doing is rolling back net neutrality protections that were formalized and codified under Obama, but have been in place for a long time. The idea that every American who basically, everybody needs high-speed access to the internet. It's just the way that things work in our world now. There is kind of a right to that access, the same way that people need water and electricity. So under Obama, this really did formally become the law of the land, to borrow a phrase that the Republicans have been using about mm-hmm. healthcare. And what seems to be the plan at this point is to just tear all of that apart so that it can become a profit free-for-all for broadband ISPs, for cable companies, for everybody who controls those traffic lanes. Interestingly, the people who are going to be most screwed by this are probably going to be the rural poor, people in small towns and in underserved and less connected, marginalized communities. We don't live in a world anymore where it makes sense to ration internet connectivity, or where it's going to be fair for you to have 10 or 1,000 times the broadband speed that I do because I am poor and you are in an upper income class. There's lots of things that are wrong about this. It's not just about your right to download your favorite TV series 30 seconds faster. This is about something much more fundamental.
So the argument is that, or it was under the Obama administration, that this is, the internet is basically a utility.
That's right.
So, and
the Title II.
The Title II utility. Yeah. And that was designed a long time ago.
More than 80 years
ago.
Yeah.
So the FCC chair is saying, look, you know, it's out of date. This was designed when we had a telephone company called
Ma Bell. Right.
You know, that's how quaint it sounds.
The phone monopoly.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was unfair, and that this is actually in the best interest of the consumer to have competition so that you will have more services, that you will have more companies entering into this marketplace.
Yeah. That's what the argument from big corporate broadband has been for years. And the counter argument is that the internet is an essential part of life, and it doesn't make sense to ask the fox to guard the hen house. So we're essentially entering an era where in different aspects of our economy and our culture and the services that we need as Americans, the regulations that used to be in place that meant that the companies profiting weren't overseeing ethics on their own, we're seeing that in different spheres of American life, that's being torn away. That's kind of what's happening here. So you're asking each of these different broadband providers to essentially police their own industry. Mm-hmm. So that is frightening to me.
Okay. Also frightening, a computer telling you don't look in those chairs.
Boy, the Internet of Things is turning into the Internet of kind of scary
things. I don't
know.
So Amazon unveils, it's got Alexa, right? It's a personal assistant.
Yeah.
And so now it's unveiling this Alexa-enabled camera.
The Echo Look. I like the name, too. When I saw it, I was like, look.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? But
so what would it do? Well, what is it supposed to do?
All right. I just got to go on the record first before I even open my mouth about this, saying that anybody who wants an Amazon-controlled, always-on, 24/7 watching and listening camera in their bedroom is insane, in my humble opinion. That's IMHO on the internet. But yeah, so this is like a $199 Alexa-enabled camera, the Echo Look, that basically does everything that the original voice assistant can do, but it's also able to, that scene in Clueless with Cher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where she says she has a computer that chooses her outfits for her.
Yeah.
It's come to life.
I have a way normal life, and she's sort of walking around in her skivvies, and then all of a sudden, Well, it can catalog your clothes, and we're seeing all of these. When I log onto Facebook now, I am frequently, as a female on the internet, suggested that I might check out these different services that basically mail you different outfits based on your measurements, based on your lifestyle. So I could imagine, and this is what's being talked about, that this tool could look at you and say, you know, have you thought about cargo pants? but some of the Twitter was fun the day that this news release was first floated. People were saying, well, you know, could it look at you and say, did you just eat a really big burrito, or are you in fact pregnant?
I think Alexa's going to be a lot nicer than that, because it wants you to like her so that you'll buy products from her. Right?
You're just saying this because they're also launching drones.
Yes.
There's a camera and mic mute button on the side. Like, if I bought it, I would put a little Hello Kitty sticker or something and stick it over that, like Edward Snowden does, and take it off when I actually wanted to be analyzed by AI in my bedroom.
I mean, what could be the benefits? It could actually.
Yeah, okay.
Imagine if it were hacked.
Well,
and imagine
if,
you know,
look, we just
let's say some Russian hacker gets into your Alexa and tells you what you should wear.
Yeah, let's say, because that never happens.
No.
The good thing about this, I'm not a publicist for Amazon. I don't have to think of anything good for it. but I suppose this is inevitable. AI and the Internet of Things are going to have a love child. It's just going to happen.
And it's Alexa?
And this is kind of the first love child of those two spheres of technology to hit the mainstream. I was thinking about this morning. I really feel like what this story calls for us to do is to start thinking about, a lot of people in America don't feel like we have a representative government. I feel like we don't have representative technology. And what if companies like Amazon and Google and Microsoft and everybody, they have shareholder meetings, these publicly traded gigantic internet behemoths. What if they had user holder meetings, right? Because we're the ones who actually have to live with this bleep in our bedrooms.
We don't have to buy it. Our butts. I mean, isn't that how we vote now?
We're not
citizens, we're consumers.
Right, so you don't have to use Google. You don't have to use Facebook. You don't have to use email. You don't have to use any of this stuff, but you do. And I feel like in the future, what more and more of us are going to want to see is technology that works for us, that helps us build incrementally, pixel by pixel, bit by bit, a better life for ourselves and our families and a better world. I don't know how we get there, but I'm still allowed to dream.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web and tech commentator. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Christian Bordahl is here with the
Hello,
feedback.
Hello, Madeline
Hi.
Brand. What I just... AI and the Internet of Things
speechless.
Are going to have a love child. I am speechless. It's just, I love that. The Echo Look thing, it just brings up so many questions for me. I'm fascinated by that. Like, who is really going to be out there deciding whether my outfit works?
Well, and I can tell you.
Yes.
You're not going to like what I have to say.
Madeline is a harsh fashion critic. And where does that feed go from the camera and who has access to it? And how is Amazon going to, monetize this? And how is Echo Look going to
sell
this stuff?
I really want RuPaul to take over. I think that would be a much better.
Now we're talking.
Yes.
Yes. Just have RuPaul come by.
Someone who really has
again.
Fashion sense.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Tell me what to wear.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.